Secondly, I'd like to thank Professor Tascon and Collège de France for the invitation to be part of the lecture series.
I cannot guarantee that I'll give you solutions, but I can share some dreams and some visions we have for how we can utilize artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques to accelerate the discovery of future battery materials, in particular interfacial challenges, and with a little luck. I would like to share some of our visions for how artificial intelligence can assist us in accelerating the modeling of battery interfaces, ultimately even to the point of being able to do so-called inverse design. I'll get into the details of that a little bit later. Part of this work has been done in my group at the Technical University of Denmark, and like Professor Tascon was saying, other parts of this is an integrated part of our new large-scale research initiative called Battery 2030 Plus. So I'll try and share some of our visions for the use of artificial intelligence and why it's important to focus specifically on interfaces if we want to develop future ultra-high-performance battery technologies. So as you will hopefully see, or you will hear in the lecture series here, interfaces really govern the performance of essentially all the battery technologies that we're hoping to develop within the next 10 years, in the European context at least. If we look at traditional battery development and the role of modeling in traditional battery development, you can view it as a quite sequential process. We can start from the atomic scale modeling of materials that I and my group are also doing, and modeling slight changes in the structure or the composition of an electrode and try to see if you can improve the properties. You can then synthesize it. You can use modeling to assist in the characterization of the materials, or you can use modeling to describe cell or pack level performance. But it is a very sequential process that the modeling results and the experimental results will only get you one step forward. You can go more than one step back, but the idea is to change this paradigm of battery development. To get from the point of doing what we would term descriptive modeling to predictive modeling. So one key aspect in the work that we are doing is trying to link structure and composition of battery materials and interfaces directly to its functionality. So very often this would require us to identify so-called descriptors or fingerprints that allows us to establish these links, how changing the structure or composition ultimately changes the functionality of a battery material or battery interface. The visions that I would like to present is actually going beyond that. It is actually going even in the opposite direction. So starting from a desired functionality of your interface and deducing what structure and composition, what environmental properties are actually needed to develop this interface or to maintain the functionality of the interface. Like I said, I'm not guaranteeing you any solutions, but I'll share our dreams and visions for how this can be achieved. We have actually already moved a bit beyond the sequential process, the very Edisonian trial and error-based approach that I described on the first slide. And we are now already at a point where we can integrate theoretical calculations. It could be at the atomic scale like here, or it could be multi-scale, with the ability to synthesize battery materials and interfaces with control down at the nanometer scale. Correlate that with in situ characterization experiments performed at synchrotrons or large-scale testing. We can accelerate the development by ensuring direct links between all the quadrants of the circle here. I'll try and show one example that's also related to sync, some recent work that we did on sync air interfaces or interfaces in sync anodes for sync air batteries, alkaline. We know that many of the dopants that are now being used in primary sync air batteries will not function for multiple cycles in a battery because their position will not be regenerated every time you charge the battery. But here we can use modeling, try and predict where different additives would actually go on the sync anode and whether they would stay in the sync anode. We can then link this directly to experimental measurements like differential electrochemical mass spectrometry here that will tell us whether these dopants have, for instance, reduced the hydrogen evolution problem, which is what you see here, that by adding, for instance, two dopants here, indium and bismuth, we can reduce the amount of hydrogen that's evolved relative to the amount of oxygen, so improving the cyclic performance of the battery. We can also see how it influences the overpotentials on charge and discharge, and we can then improve cyclically our behavior of the anode. But we are specifically targeting interfaces and interfaces. Because the way we view it, not just in our group, but also in the Battery 2030 Plus in total, is that interfaces will play a critical role in all the battery chemistries that we are envisioning. So we need to develop tools that allows us to design, understand, and hopefully even control these interfaces. Like I said, the ultimate dream is to get to the point where we can do this so-called inverse design. But it really requires that we understand the fundamental physical and chemical processes governing the performance of the battery and the development of the battery interfaces. So if we change the electrode or electrolyte composition, how will that influence the interfaces in the battery? And can we control this? For instance, by having additives in the electrolyte that we can activate later on to heal the interfaces. If we look at multi-scale modeling, as it's done now, modeling of interfaces, we already know if we look at the SEI or the solid electrolyte interface or the cathode electrolyte interface, we already know now that for different degrees of evolution of the SEI, different mechanisms can control the formation and the properties of the SEI, whether it's electron tunneling, whether it's lithium ion transport, or whether it's transport of electrolytes. There are many different regimes where different fundamental mechanisms and also fundamental laws govern the properties. So certain regimes we can actually model or characterize experimentally with high level of detail. Others we cannot. And I'll get back to why this is so challenging. But let me just show you a couple of examples about how this lack of understanding of the limiting fundamental processes can actually lead to completely wrong conclusions about an interface in a battery. I'll take one other example here, which is some work that we did on lithium sulfur. We're actually just modeling the transport of ions and electrons through the redox end members. If you use conventional, what's called density functional theory, which is traditionally a pretty accurate method for describing many battery systems, but definitely not all, and we look at the transport mechanisms governing, like I said, the electronic and the ionic transport, we actually end up missing the conclusion completely. Because it turns out that the transport through the transport between the sulfur ring, is not an adiabatic process. It's actually a non-adiabatic process. And by not knowing this, we would actually miscalculate the rate of electron transport by two orders of magnitude. And for the lithium sulfur battery, that is actually the turning point whether or not you can make a practically relevant sulfur battery or not. So we need to understand the fundamental processes if we're going to be able to design even better batteries. Just give one more example from the emerging battery technologies. So if we look at lithium oxygen batteries, we know that there are many different ways you can deposit lithium peroxide on the positive electrode. But we know that if it's a surface-based mechanism where you gradually deposit lithium peroxide as you discharge your lithium oxygen battery, and you grow pristine films of lithium peroxide, it's a high band gap material, so you will ultimately be limited by electron transport. We know that if the only transport mechanism is tunneling, you will basically die off at around a thickness of only 5-6 nanometers. The interesting thing to note is that there are actually also other mechanisms that can transport charge through this insulating layer. So you can have polarons. So if you have either slightly higher temperature, you can activate polaron hopping. Or if you have parasitic reactions happening in your battery where you also have lithium carbonate formation, transport of these polarons is actually much faster at interfaces between lithium peroxide and lithium carbonate. And I can assure you, for those that have done experiments at least with a carbonate-based electrolyte, you will form lithium carbonate on the electrode. So if we don't get the fundamental mechanisms right, we cannot really assert that we have predictive accuracy. So an essential part in the modeling work that we're doing in Battery 2030 Plus is establishing what we would term the battery interface genome. So if we look at modeling at different scales, we are really able to do good predictions on the elemental properties of, or at least the theoretical properties of a new electrode materials or an electrolyte, whether it's the transfer numbers, many things we can actually do. But if we want to get to the point of designing new, durable, ultra-high performance battery materials, we really need to target the interface. Understand what are the limiting processes and how to control the limiting processes at the interface. So we're spending a lot of effort on developing this understanding for interfaces in batteries. I've talked a lot about modeling, but it's actually not enough. If we want to get this type of insight, it's not enough only to do modeling. Like I mentioned in one of the previous slides, we know that many different mechanisms can actually be limiting the transport through the interface. But if we are in a regime where we know exactly what fundamental law governs the transport, we can make very good predictions. But if we're at the later stages of solid electrolyte or the SEI formation or even the cracking or degradation, many different mechanisms come into play. The only way we can get sufficient data for the data-driven models or this AI or machine learning that I'll talk about is really if we combine information from a multitude of different domains. So both modeling at different scales, scales that allow us to look at electron transport, scales that allow us to look at transport in the electrolyte, but also data from experiments. And I'll show the importance of data from all the different regimes if we're going to get to the point of inverse design. One way of getting, you can say, training for your machine learning-based models is to get this very good mapping between the data input and the output, or the labels that you can put on. One way of doing that is, of course, to do highly idealized experiments or highly idealized model systems. So one example here is actually looking at impurities of HF in the electrolyte and how that forms lithium fluoride on a pristine gold a 111 facet. So this is, of course, a far cry from the battery interfaces that we're really interested in. But we can link then ab initio molecular dynamics simulations to XPS experiments performed at synchrotrons and get very detailed information about this one possible reaction taking place at the interface. Of course, we know if we change the electrode, if we change the composition of the electrolyte, different mechanisms will come into play. But this is one way of training part of the algorithm that you get high fidelity, as we would call it, high fidelity modeling and high fidelity experiments that will give you large data sets where you're really sure that you're modeling specific individual reactions. But like I said, for full batteries, we are dealing with mechanisms that span a multitude of both time and length scales. So down to the femtosecond time scale for electron transfer, ultimately up to designing utility devices for decades. Of course, to be honest, there is no way that a single, holistic, multi-scale approach can span all of those timescales. But one way that artificial intelligence and machine learning can help us to do this is, for instance, to identify which parameters we need to transfer from one domain to another domain. It can also help us to identify links between fast time scale or short length scale reactions to the large time or length scale mechanisms. Things that are difficult to envision because it is a multi-dimensional optimization challenge. I'll show you some examples of how challenging this is. But just to give you one example about how machine learning can actually be used, machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence that I'll describe in the next slide. But this is a computer simulation of what is traditionally viewed as relatively high level or high quality, high fidelity data, so-called ab initio molecular dynamics, where we're modeling interactions between an electrolyte and an electrode, a pristine model electrode surface, and we're generating time series. And those of you that can read it, it acts as picoseconds. If you want to do sufficiently accurate statistics, you actually need to run this for a number of times at what would correspond to different potentials if you want to be able to deduce what surface species are found at relevant potentials and how does that influence the performance of the electrode. What might not be visible here is that this is two years of a postdoc's life, just that one plot. That is basically 10 million CPU hours. Even knowing that, we also know that this is actually not accurate enough. There are certain of the bonds that are being made or broken at this high level of theory that we actually do not describe well enough. But we can then combine that with machine learning techniques or ensemble techniques that help us to identify the origin of the systematic errors and correct for those. If we're fortunate enough, we have high-quality experiments. If we are not fortunate enough, we can actually use quantum chemical calculations or couple cluster calculations that are even more expensive. We can then correct this data set that we have and train machine learning models on this improved data set. So these are simple, fast calculations that allow us to describe the interaction of the electrode-electrolyte at much longer time and length scales than we can with the more accurate methods. But we can actually get to the point where they can be more accurate in some of the predictions because we've corrected some of the errors. Okay, just to say a little bit about machine learning and artificial intelligence and the kind of tools that we need for modeling battery interfaces, I'll show a few slides, but I won't go into details about any specific technique. Many of you might have seen this before. So artificial intelligence is not a new concept. It's basically the technique that enables a computer to mimic, you can say, human intelligence to do sort of decision tree-based conclusions. The subset that we are dealing quite a lot with, so-called machine learning. So this is a subset of artificial intelligence to a very large extent based on statistical tools that enables the machines to improve. They learn depending on how much training data they have available and the quality of the training data they have available. So this is one way that the methods actually improve themselves over time. The part that we're spending a lot of time on at the moment is so-called deep learning. So this is a subset of machine learning that allows the algorithms to actually improve themselves. You are using it probably every day if you're using speech or image recognition on your iPhone or whatever mobile phone you're using. All of these tools are actually implemented already. If you ask Siri a question on your iPhone, she'll be using deep learning to decide what to recommend you. In machine learning, there are sort of three different regimes that I just need briefly to describe. One is so-called supervised learning. So that is where you give the input or the data, but you also supply the answer or the label. The algorithm can then become better and better at producing the right answer, but it knows pretty much what it's supposed to do. The other part, which is really the domain that we're entering into, is so-called unsupervised learning, where we can provide the data, but the algorithm itself has to find, you can say, patterns. It can find different regimes that correspond to different learnings. So it has to identify patterns in the data itself. Another aspect called reinforcement learning, this is where the methods gradually become better and better and sort of limit the cost of doing the calculation. So it improves itself over time. One technique that is essential for the deep learning is so-called neural networks, or in particular, deep neural networks. This is something that mimics, to a large extent, the way the brain functions. That you have, you could look at this as neurons sending signals in so-called hidden layers. So if you start by recognizing a lot of faces, I mean, to us, it's pretty easy to recognize whether it's a face. To the algorithm, it's not as easy. But the algorithm can then deconvolute it into a looking for, let's say, edges. Let's say, for instance, a contrast that is related to the hair. And depending on how many of these neurons are then activated, if it's something that you see in pretty much all the faces, it will have a high weight. And it can then carry information into these hidden layers that look for special features, facial features, that ultimately enables the machine to deduce this is a face, this is maybe even a blonde person at the age of so-and-so. So this is something that is well-suited to treat the complexity of the multitude of physical and chemical interactions that we're interested in modeling, and also, as I'll show in a little bit, span multiple time and length scales, because that is definitely a critical issue in the type of modeling that we're proposing to do. So just to illustrate what it is that we're really hoping to achieve in this, it's called Battery 30 Plus for a reason. It is actually at least a 10-year vision that we're presenting here. So this is not something you'll be able to do next week. Well, if you are, give me a call. But the idea is how we can use artificial intelligence and machine learning to accelerate the discovery. And I'll show how different parts of the discovery process will rely on sort of well-established machine learning techniques, And other parts will rely on concepts from AI, so-called active learning, that allows the algorithm to query or to ask for data from the domain or the experiment or the simulation or the test that provides the most valuable data at that specific point. This is a key concept in the process for accelerating the discovery. Basically, knowing what you don't know and knowing where to ask. This is not as easy as it sounds. But a key part in that is establishing the battery interface genome, so understanding the fundamentals of how interfaces form and how they behave over time. The goal is really to achieve a massive acceleration in our ability to design new battery materials and interfaces by combining, and this is a novelty in the field, by combining so-called data-driven models, like I talked about, machine learning and AI, with physical models. Typically, they're viewed as separate domains or separate approaches, but they are actually complementary. And we really need the complementarity if we're going to achieve the goals that we have set out for ourselves. So like I mentioned in the beginning, and the reason I showed these relatively idealized simulations or experiments, is that for those, we know which physical laws actually govern the performance. So there we can train the models with high accuracy. We can have high level of low level of uncertainty or high level of certainty on the predictions that we make. But there are other regimes where we're really, really far off. And we're making, in some cases, not even educated guesses. But we can use the data-driven methods to provide suggestions for parameters that we can then use in the physical models. And we can use physical laws to tell us when these are out of bounds, when they violate the laws of physics. Because very often, the machine learning will actually propose things that cannot be synthesized, violate laws of physics, because it's not encoded in its DNA to limit yourself. But we can do this, and this is our vision, that we actually want to do this in our design platform. I'll just briefly say a few design or sort of concepts that are essential for the design platform that I'll show. One is so-called Bayesian inference. It's basically telling you what is the quality of the model given the data that you have. So when you have more data, you can also improve the model. And this is important because, like I said in the beginning, knowing what you don't know or how uncertain your predictions are is actually essential for this to work. Because you need to know when you don't know, and then you need to go to the best place to get that information that will improve your predictions. Another part is convolution. I won't talk too much about convolution, but for interfaces in particular, this is something that is very good at identifying specific features related to special bonds being formed at interfaces, for instance. Another aspect is the ability to forecast or predict, because we really want to be able to predict what the interface will do next, or what happens if I change the external parameters. If I go from a C rate of 6.5 to a C rate of 1, what happens? If I change the temperature, if I put an additive in the electrolyte. So many of the methods that are being used now are not really good at that. They're getting better, but they're not really good at that. Another part is learning from history, learning from prior knowledge. And this is something that's actually essential. You need to know as much as you can about your previous history if you're going to be able to do the inverse design, because that's basically going from your endpoint backwards. And if you lose track of your history, it's almost impossible to go back. So that's another part where so-called recurrent networks are important. The part that I said where we are now is the ability to do, you could say, nowcasting or predicting the very near future, but really we would like this to be able to predict much longer into the future. So now I'll share our vision for a so-called materials acceleration platform. This is one way of designing a platform that will allow us or the AI to acquire the right kind of information at the right time. So we can do atomic scale simulations of interfaces and design new battery materials, but we also need our AI to be able to control the synthesis of new materials based on the information available. We can then make the materials or the interfaces with high control, but we also need to be able to do in situ in operando characterization and actually analyze that data on the fly. we have to do multi-scale simulations spanning many scales, have so-called machine learning modules that allow us to do this analysis on the fly. That requires that we have a common data infrastructure. It also requires that we are able to utilize information from, I've showed that towards the very end, hopefully within 10 years, at least also for manufacturing and testing. The AI that's supposed to do this active learning is able to query data from all of these domains all the time. So it has some subset of data. It can actually be from literature, I'll show that. It can be from databases that are already generated, or it can be from experiments being performed at a synchrotron nearby, modeling databases that we have. But then it learns on the fly. This is this active learning where it can query, say, okay, we are entering into a region I can't really see from modeling. I need to do a characterization experiment. I do the automated analysis here. It feeds more data into my databases, and I can update this on the fly and develop new infrastructures. So, is this feasible? Well, let me show you one example from last week of what is feasible. This is from a company called OpenAI that demonstrated a new code that they had developed where they fed it a text string. I'm sorry, the resolution is not particularly good. But this is talking about how a silver unicorn was found in this particular valley in the Andes Mountains. And the most interesting thing was that it was able to speak English perfectly. What is then done is that the algorithm is being trained on 40 gigabytes of internet text. It's the only thing it's been trained on. So this is what the amount of data you can have in your cell phone. By just finding patterns, and it then generates, I encourage you to look this up. If you're not scared at heart, I encourage you to look this up. It then generates an entire story about how Dr. Jorge Perez and his colleagues found this, and an excruciating level of detail that's actually very plausible for this highly unplausible story. But this is trained only on 40 gigabytes of data. When this was published, Elon Musk opted out of the company. He was too afraid of this. So just to say that even on 40 gigabytes of data, if we look at the kind of experiments we're doing, either the synchrotron or if we're doing this ab initio MD simulations, we generate terabytes. If we look at earth sciences, where some of these concepts are now also starting to be implemented, generate petabytes, closely to petabytes per day. So this is 1 million times the total training set that was used for this. That being said, text is much, much simpler than what we're dealing with. But just to illustrate that it's not completely impossible. Okay, so the goal is truly to do the inverse design and invert the discovery and optimization procedure. So we want to get to the point where the performance targets ultimately design the original materials but also tells us what environmental properties we have to either apply or don't apply for this interface to be formed. I'll show one example of some work that we're doing now in another European project, which is including machine learning and so-called cluster expansion methods to describe a new class of lithium electrodes. So these are lithium-rich FCC electrodes, which is basically a three-dimensional lithium electrode, super simple rock salt structure. The problem is that it's disordered. So you have disorder in both the cation and the anion site. And this makes it calculationally extremely complicated because different regions of order or disorder will have very different properties. We can make these accelerated predictions, and we can then predict what is the open circuit voltage as a function of lithiation and compare that with experiments. That's a good starting point. We couldn't do that a year or two ago. But it's actually not the whole story or what we're really getting at. Because we can also use this method in combination with machine learning and see how changes in the structure from this layered structure into structures with partially ordered and partially disordered systems, how that influences the power density that we can get. How the local structural environment actually relates specifically to the power density that we can get. And for that, we can use machine learning. So we can train it on high-level calculations that tell us what is the barrier for a lithium jump based on only knowing its local environment. So this is what we would call a structural fingerprint. By knowing what atoms are surrounding the lithium, how lithiated the system is, we can then predict, based on machine learning that is trained on higher quality data, we can then predict what is the barrier for jumping for lithium in one direction. Because the methods are so fast, we can then predict the total power density in the system as a function of lithiation, even including disorder. So this is something that is sort of one step towards the complexity of the interfaces, but it's not getting there fully. But we are getting closer. A key aspect for any of this to work is truly to get to the point where we have enormous amounts of data available. The good thing about many of the machine learning methods is that they actually train well on what we would label as bad data. So data from failed experiments, or data where it's practically not possible to synthesize a given material. That information actually has value to the models that we're developing here. But it's also important to stress that we don't have good data infrastructure that spans all of these elements. So whether it's looking up old literature, whether it's doing screening studies in the computer or big science testing, all of that actually requires that we have a shared data infrastructure that allows the AI to search the different domains. This is something that will be a key element in the flagship project, but it's also a key element in all other aspects of data handling and data management. So when I say data, there are really many, many aspects that we have to take into account. So one thing is, of course, collecting it. Another thing is how you handle it. How do you include metadata? So the power glitch that happened during this degradation test, or how do you include the fact that modeling is done at different levels of fidelity or higher levels of accuracy methods? All of that has to be included in the data that you provide for it to make sense. The good thing is that a lot of data is being generated, and a lot of data is also being shared now. So many of you probably know the ICSD, the Crystal Structure Database. That's a pretty big database. Many of you probably know journal articles. It's still a reasonably large database. It's a little harder to query or to look up the data. But a lot of databases are actually being developed at the, you can say, at the atomic scale of modeling of materials that rapidly provides more and more data sources, but it also provides them in a closer to homogeneous data format. Take one example from one of our colleagues, Nicola Massari at EPFL, who's developed a so-called AIDA and Materials Cloud, which is a framework for sharing data at the atomic scale, but sharing it across different calculational codes. So this is the kind of framework that we really need to establish, not only for simulations at different scales, but also for experiments at different scales, even including testing, that the data is shared in a format that you can query all of the data at once. It's not trivial. So now, that was pretty much in the wish list part. So now I'm getting to some of the things that we can actually already do. An important thing in generating this data is to be able to translate experiments like this is, I think, lithium intercalation in graphite, I think, that you see on the left. You see peaks forming and peaks disappearing as a function of lithiation. And we can then look up in the ICSD and see this corresponds to stage one, this corresponds to stage two, so forth. And we can make predictions and send it back. But if we see a new feature, something we hadn't seen before, maybe there's a little bit of silicon in there or something else, then the method should be able to detect that something new is happening here. And even if it cannot see that in the database that it has, it can still make predictions based on the original compounds that went into the electrolyte, for instance, its knowledge of similar systems, and it can make a projection. Whether it's a good or bad projection depends on the amount of data it has available. But a lot of new methods associated with specific techniques are coming out now. I'll just show a couple of examples. So there are actually methods out there that are reasonably accurate for NMR, for XAS, but also for X-ray diffraction data that can deconvolute a spectrum like you have here into possible candidate spectrum and then identify what is the most likely candidate, but probably also what other impurities are in there. Methods are also being developed now that automatically detects and subtracts your background. So if you have background in your laboratory, X-ray diffraction, for instance, it can detect that and subtract that and still deduce what are the peaks and what do they most likely correspond to. So these modules are out there and are being developed as we speak. One important aspect in using experimental data is, you can say, the difference or the distinction between high throughput and high fidelity. So high fidelity to us means high quality data. It's a simple way of putting it. But for the machine learning models, which live on data, at some points in time and space, I'll show a couple of examples, more data at a lower quality can actually be more valuable than little data with very high quality. If it's for validating the domains where you have the physical laws that allows you to label data, a few data points with very high quality are very important. But the method needs to know when to query low fidelity or low quality, lower quality but faster experiments, and when to query high quality data. Just to illustrate how we view the linking of theory and experiment and also different methods, because ultimately we want to suggest which materials to synthesize or which additives to have in your electrolyte. So we can use, for instance, DFT calculations to suggest what species form, but we can also go the opposite way and say, okay, now we have UV-VIS or we have Raman data, we can go back and deduce what is the most likely species on the surface that corresponds. So here, this is pretty much where we are today. We can also do it at other link scales, so we can go in and say, okay, what is the change in the potential? We can do kinetic Monte Carlo modeling. We can also do, for slightly thicker layers, we can do XPS, or we can do in operando XRD, and then we can do this input interpretation. But ultimately, we would really like to be able to get all up to the point where we can describe even aging. You can say at certain points, having the high quality data is really, really important. Other points, having much data that is maybe at a lower quality is even more important for the training of the model. But I think one key thing that I'd like to stress is uncertainty. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Donald Rumsfeld's quote about the known knowns, and in particular the unknown unknowns, because this is really the situation that we're in. That we are, in certain regimes, we know what we don't know. But there are really also regimes in the lifetime of battery interfaces where we don't really know what it is that we don't know. But assigning uncertainty to the predictions, so the AI-based models, but also to the data points that we get in. So here, this is one field where the experimental world is ahead of the simulational world, because assigning uncertainties to simulations is actually not something that's done very much. But we've developed methods that allows you to do this using machine learning and so-called dissipation inference to get uncertainties on your predictions by actually doing, in this case, 2,000 different calculations at a very low cost, because we're basically letting the machine learning try to set up new ways of calculating the method that gives you then an idea of how these likely simulations, how they could model the system. It gives you then an optimized way of modeling the specific system, but it also gives you a spread. So it gives you something about the confidence that you can have in your data. Depending on the challenge you're modeling, the smaller or larger this error bar will be, or this uncertainty will be. I'd like to spend a little time on this slide, because it outlines a little bit of the concept of how different methods, whether it's different theoretical methods, whether it's different spectroscopies or electrochemical characterization techniques, really have their prime in different parts of the challenge of SEI evolution. There are certain techniques that are super good, whether we're looking at the modeling I showed earlier about the initial degradation or reactions with additives from the electrolyte on the electrode, or whether it's transport properties or through thin layers of the SEI. Certain methods have their prime in different parts of the, you can say, interface evolution. The color coding here, to some extent, it's a very schematic approach, represents where certain methods would have their prime, where you could say you get the most value for money. But like I said, it might actually be important to use faster methods to generate enough data in certain parts of this regime. So knowing when a method becomes more and more uncertain is essential for making the right decision on where to go to get your data. And this is the way that we can accelerate the discovery process by knowing exactly where to go to optimize the models. So, important thing to keep in mind is the value to cost, and cost in this sense can be both fiscal cost or financial cost, and it can be time. Some of these experiments take longer than others, but that ratio is dynamic. It's important to bear in mind that a certain technique is not equally suited for all time and length scales that we are interested in. Another aspect that we are dealing very much with is this, that the models have to be aware of the physics. We call them physics-aware models. This is actually from a paper that's also only 1 week old from Earth Sciences. So that's one of the areas where we do have a lot of data and where some of these methods are being developed, because a lot of us are interested in the forecasting, at least the forecasting of weather a few days ahead. But drought, things like that are essential to be able to do reliable forecasting, which is also in a longer time range. But one of the things that is being developed in this field and we are also trying to utilize is the combination of the physical and the data-driven models. So I showed you this convolutional network. So this was one of the things that was good at finding these features that you then map on to something that's called a latent space. I won't go into the details about that, but this is finding these trends between data points in real space that allows you to optimize and then go back and making predictions about how the system will evolve in real time. But what they do here is that they actually add a physical model layer on top, saying the predictions that came out of this machine learning code, are they actually violating physical laws? If they do, then we discard them. Go back. It sounds simple, but it's actually not something that's being done very much. The other part, which is also something that we are looking into for the battery interfaces, are the so-called recurrent neural networks. I'll show you in a little bit. I showed you all of these hidden layers in the deep neural networks. The idea in the recurrent neural networks is that they're actually able to go back in time and revisit their memory. This is one way that you can improve the predictions. So if you come with, let's say, here it's precipitation, it's temperature and radiation, and then hopefully you can make predictions on photosynthesis, I think is what they have up here. The recurrent neural network and this so-called long short-term memories is actually, you can say, dealing with one of the main challenges in making these time evolutions that we are really trying to do. There's a big difference between recognizing a cat in an image and actually predicting whether that cat will jump or not. Because if you only have the picture, I mean, you can see if all the muscles tense up and there's a mouse over there, there's a big chance that it will jump. But if it's just sitting there on the sofa, it's very difficult to predict that it's going to jump. So having memory in the learning models is actually extremely difficult to get in. But recurrent neural networks is one way of including that. But what you can see illustrated here is for every layer you go through here, it gradually loses the information from the previous layers. And this is a critical aspect if you want to be able to do the back propagation in time that we're really interested in, going from your end interface back to deciding what original compound should I put in my electrolyte, how should I treat my battery system. So this is definitely something that hasn't been resolved yet. But it's something that that we are working on. So predicting spatio-temporal, so both time and space, or dynamics, is something that's extremely difficult. It's also something that's being pursued a lot. So in video predictions, for instance, what will happen in the next frame? Who will do what? Will the cat jump in front of a car? Or in this case, it's just a pillow being thrown into space or into air. And you would say it's going to follow a parabola. But that actually depends on what happened, if there was a wind gust, or if you were rotating it in one way that you could not see previously. So making these types of predictions, even on very short time scales, is very tricky. So this is not something we have the solution to yet, at least not a solution we can afford, but it's an area where you can say both the history and the environment are important properties. Again, assigning uncertainties to your predictions is also essential. So this part about knowing what to query or what to ask for when you need to reduce your uncertainty. That's a critical aspect. The last part of the talk here, I have two small things. This is just describing a model that we have proposed for one way of actually being able to do this inverse design of battery interfaces. So you'll see a lot of things up here you probably won't recognize. What you see here is the semi-supervised. So now we're sort of in between the supervised part where we know input and labels and the unsupervised where we're searching for patterns. Because we know that there are domains where we actually know which physical laws govern the process, and there we can do the supervised learning, and there are other regions where we really don't know and we need to do the unsupervised part. This is this deep generative model. This is what I showed in the previous slides here. There are a couple of examples of how this can be done. I'll show that in a little bit. But what you can see here is that this is a specific configuration. This could be a composition of your electrode and your electrolyte that you start with. You then evolve it over time. So this is called Markov chain. So you evolve it over time, and it has these, you can say, time-varying operating conditions. This could be the C rates that Professor Tascon talked about earlier. It could be the temperature. You can then have different observables. Depending on whether you ask for DFT simulation, you ask for XAS characterization, you can then go in and detect that observable and evolve the system over time. You can then use these long short-term memory or recurrent neural networks to predict the time evolution. What you can also do is then, based on the information you have here, you can make new suggestions. So you can use some of these generative models that it can be one I'll show briefly, so-called variational autoencoder or genetic algorithms, to make new predictions and say, well, it actually worked pretty well up until this point, but then we used a too high C rate. We need to add or change the electrolyte composition to have additives in there that will allow us to do higher C rate testing. Ultimately, we can then propose new materials to be synthesized and refed into our evolution algorithm. So it's an active learning scheme, which means that it learns on the fly and it gets data from the different domains. And it then uses a cost function to decide where do I get the most value for my money. Is it this type of experiment or this type of simulation? Just to show you that there are many different ways that this can be done, the example that I showed here and that what we are also working with, the so-called variational autoencoders, that then take something, in this case it's a molecule from a flow battery, this is an anthraquinone, and then deconvolutes it into this latent space where you can find trends. You can then, also if you're missing part of your data, that is one way that you can actually still find trends in the latent space. You can then decode it back into a better prediction of what is in your system. You can also have so-called generative adversary networks. So this is basically where the method proposes different descriptions of your interface and then pitches them against each other and gradually learns. You can combine them in a number of different ways. And the future will tell which of these will be most efficient for the predictive modeling of battery interfaces. The way we are viewing it is, at this point, one of the most relevant ways or most likely approaches to this is to do the semi-supervised deep generative learning model that then tells you how combinations of additives from molecular space, additives to the electrolyte, the electrodes you have, and the observed microstructure or nanostructure you have, encoding that into this so-called latent space, and then using genetic algorithms or reinforcement learning in general to come up with new suggestions and ultimately then design battery interfaces. The last part that I wanted to say is just, if we're already out of this, you can say, 8 years from now, we really also want to be able to control the synthesis at a very high, you can say, high level of detail. So already, instead of going to the end of this sequential development cycle and making an entire interface and seeing if it works and then starting all over, we might end up stopping after only doing a few simulations or one experiment and saying, no, we really need to change the properties of the electrolyte. And that can only be done if you have access to all of the data from all the different domains at once. But we can handle organic materials if it's for electrolyte additives. That can actually be done, and we can learn quite a bit about that from the pharmaceutical industry. Because a number of these concepts are actually being used in biotechnology and in pharmaceutical industry, where you're looking at molecular fragments that you can then add and change. So a lot of these things are being developed, and I think that's important for us to stress as modeling people, battery people, that we can actually learn from, whether it's Google or other companies on the artificial intelligence side, or whether it's from the pharmaceutical industry, and we really need to if we're going to be able to do this in 10 years. But how can you do machine learning here? Well, you can actually just let machine learning algorithms just determine whether or not you open for a certain valve. You can do characterization. This is an optical characterization. It doesn't really matter. And say, oh, no, sorry, that was too much. You then change the property of this valve. This is something that we can actually do. We can do it on the organic side. It is much more complicated to do it on inorganics. So within a 10-year framework like we are dealing with in Battery 2030 Plus, I would say that we should be able to do the organic part autonomously, so without human intervention. The inorganic part is a little more tricky. But one thing that we can do is combine modeling. This is also modeling of synthesizability. Because if you look at all the materials that are already out there and map those in intelligent ways, you can actually make predictions on the likelihood of a new composition being stable when you try to synthesize it. These are not super accurate, but if you have enough data, you can actually make pretty reliable predictions. So I would call that AI-guided synthesis, saying that that electrode composition that you would like, that would give you exactly the interface that you want, that you can only synthesize if you add a certain amount of manganese or another element. A lot can be learned from, you can say, from the molecular fragments, but a lot still has to be learned for batteries, in particular for the combination of organics and inorganics. It's just to illustrate the many different things you put in electrolytes today, and a lot of those things we can actually optimize on the fly. The very last thing that I wanted to show us as one example is that all of this is really at, you can say, at the materials level. In time, I won't put a timeline on it, we also need to be able to include manufacturing and fabrication. Because you can have the best materials, but if you cannot fabricate them. Also, if you try to make a magnesium battery, actually rolling it up in the cell is difficult with the magnesium foil. So there are many things that we also need to include in the optimization of batteries if we really want to get all the way to the cell level. So there's some nice work, and Alejandro Franco and his ERC Consolidated Grant about trying to implement machine learning techniques in optimizing the manufacturing processes. More work also has to be done in this. Just to give you a few perspectives, a little bit of an outlook. I don't know if I convinced you, but at least I've shared some of our visions and our dreams. And like I said, I didn't promise any solutions, but at least these are some of our dreams. That we can transition from this Edisonian and sequential battery development. And one way of doing that is to use machine learning and artificial intelligence in certain parts of the discovery process. In particular, developing methods that allows, you can say, this active learning where the method is able to go and get data from the simulation, experiment, or the test where it gets the most value at that specific point in time. Whether it's to reduce the uncertainty in the system or validate which physical domain you're in, if it's electron tunneling or so forth, that part is going to be key if we're going to achieve this acceleration that I talked about. Another part, which is, I mean, we are pretty much already there, is that you can do this autonomous or semi-autonomous interpretation of characterization data. This really doesn't mean that the computers can do a better job than the experimentalists doing the experiment. But it means that they can do the same job. It means that they will make the same conclusion based on the data, whether it's done in my lab or in a lab here at Collège de France, or it's done in Asia. They will make the same conclusions and likely also the same uncertainties or same errors. We proposed one way of doing this. This, you could call it physics-aware data-driven models, but where you have both the physical models and the data-driven models working together and building on their strengths, and then doing these deep generative learning models that allows you to predict into the future. Still, this is the very near future. We have to be honest to say that it requires a lot of data to do this right. The other aspect that I mentioned, the ability to do this value assessment on the fly. What do I really need the most right now? That's another aspect that that we'll be spending quite a bit of time on. Good and bad data. So you would think that the fact that these models train well on bad data should be good. But it's actually not trivial to get, you can say, all the sectors that have valuable information, whether it's academia, whether it's research institutes, or whether it's us driving our cars. Are we willing to share all the drive patterns, even when we were speeding in a school zone? Are we willing to share all that information to improve the batteries of the future? It's not trivial, but sharing of data, good and bad, is a key aspect. We have put all of these ideas together into something that we call Big Map. I think actually due to a lawsuit here in France, I think we could have called it Big Mac now. I think McDonald's lost the claim to the name, but I think we call it Big Map, which is combining the interface understanding with the materials acceleration. And I think for us, at least in Battery 2030 Plus, you can correct me, this is an important part of developing a sustainable and commercially competitive battery production in Europe, that we need to develop methodologies that can look into the future and can leapfrog some of our activities. If you think this doesn't sound too crazy, you're more than welcome to come and endorse us here at this website. You can click on it and say they're not completely crazy. But at least I hope that some of you will go and take a look. And with that, I would just like to acknowledge the people that did this work. I think it's very important to stress that I didn't do any of it, basically. That it's a couple of our postdocs, Agir Bohomik and Peter Bjørn, who did the development of the deep generative model, Rune Christensen on the uncertainty estimations, and Jin-Yun Chang and Sten Lysgaard on combining genetic algorithms and machine learning techniques, and cluster expansion machine learning techniques. A lot of our experimental collaborators, Ole Winter on the fundamentals of deep learning, but also our collaborators. So here I've listed some that are specifically involved in the projects that we have here, but this list could actually have been very long because a lot of the method development that is being done here is being developed to be versatile, that is being developed on different systems to be able to treat new emerging chemistries and materials that we haven't even thought about yet. And I think that's another a very important part of what we're doing. Last but not least, I've shown some examples from different funding projects. We haven't really gotten that much money out of this yet, but we're hoping to get that, so I put it up anyway. Anyway, this is a new project we have at home where we are developing the methodologies for accelerated discovery. And with that, just thank you for listening.